Strangled. Strangled. Plastic woes unseen had weighted down what rose of spring. And so I'd been, or at least felt sensitive. Till breath, the steep horizon scent, turned jealous to regenerative.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Solocene. This week we are talking about Marie Kondo. This is a continuation of our semester populating a Mount Rushmore of people who will inspire and populate a beautiful, sustainable, tactile future called the Solocene. Marie Kondo is the first person who we have mixed feelings about. We both really like her and her concepts, but it may be more of an honorary mention than a proper memorialization.
Yeah, I think none of the episodes have been 100% endorsements for the simple fact that we haven't personally known any of them besides Gustave, who was an invented figure entirely. But yeah, I think today is going to be a bit more of a nuanced discussion than the usual celebration. Let's say we'll be discussing her tidying methods and the wider, I would say, scheme of minimalism that they fall into, which is comprised, I would say, of many different Solocene tenets, but also some that are a little bit un-utopian. And my poem at the start started with a very un-utopian word, strangled. Wow, the most imaginative and world-building and inspiring word of all. It's a bit of an insight into how material and consumer culture can make you feel, even if speaking quite dramatically. I mean, there's the really extreme examples that you see, some of the homes that Marie Kondo entered, where it's just like a hoarder's domicile, but also sometimes you don't need to take it to that level to feel overwhelmed, maybe is a more subtle word for it.
Absolutely. Lots of people often struggling with mental illnesses will say that their spaces reflect the inside of their brain. So if they're having a really hard time, their space becomes a bit more overwhelming, and vice versa. When you're doing really well, it'll be a bit more tidy. And Marie Kondo's method often attempts to invert that relationship of creating a space that creates space in your mind or in your social life, even to have a more joyful time here on Earth. Marie Kondo is much younger than I thought she was, to be honest.
Well, you watched the show, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So this is slightly similar to our Harambe episode, where we kind of joke that we're just covering pop culture 7 years too late.
Yeah.
But in this case, I think her Netflix show launched in 2019. So that was kind of her big popularity introduction to the West. And of course, you were just feverishly binging, I might say.
I did really like the show. It also came at a good time right before the pandemic. So a lot of people watched it and then most likely rewatched it or applied a lot of those techniques once forced to
confront
the space they were living in, because a lot of us pre-pandemic spent very little time in our homes. You'd be at university, you'd be at work, but then all of a sudden you were there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And because our homes all of a sudden became so multi-use, whereas they used to simply be for sleeping, they became your office, your home gym, your restaurant, your cafe. You had to really rethink the space you had. And I remember those first few weeks having the epiphany, I need to learn how to make coffee. Mm-hmm. Because until that point, I didn't know how to make good coffee. And so I went and I got pour over filter, a scale, and all of these things, and then set up a home cafe.
Sounds like the pandemic really hit you hard.
Yeah, exactly. And some people had to do the same with a home office, or perhaps even reshaping their bedrooms, because a lot of students only had a dorm or had one room in a house, and that all of a sudden had to become your library, your space for studying, your space for Zooming. So had to really rethink the space in a way that we never had before. And Marie Kondo had a big hand in that, I believe.
The new conspiracy would be that she was involved in the scheming of the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. But Marie Kondo is only 39, which surprised me, because I find often those very TLC lifestyle TV hosts are often older. They're people who have built this reputation in an industry. I'm thinking of Judge Judy, of Super Nanny, all of these types of people. But Marie Kondo, from the age of 19, had this organizing consulting agency, which is so funny to me. But it makes sense when I read a little bit about her childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, She claims at the age of 5 is when she got into organization. And this was, she was born in Osaka, Japan, so was raised there as well. And at the time, when she was 5 years old, feng shui became really popular. It hit the Japanese community and took them by storm. And her mom was really into feng shui, but 5-year-old Marie was saying, too cluttered for feng shui to work.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, feng shui, I'll talk about it a bit later, but it's the passage of energy through a space. And so it's arranging things so that the energy can move and you can feel harmonious with your environment and vice versa. And her mom was trying to do this, but Marie thought, it's too cluttered. So she started implementing these decluttering things. And also, when she was in junior school, she would always try to get the role of bookshelf organizer. Other kids would be in charge of feeding the class pet or giving announcements or whatever, but she would always want to be the one organizing a bookshelf. And apparently at one point, during an organizing frenzy, she passed out from an anxiety attack, I suppose. Was unconscious for 2 hours, and she said when she came to, a voice of some tidying god said to her, look at things more closely. And then she came conscious again. And what look at things more closely made her realize was sidetracked with throwing things out, but then she realized you should focus on sparking joy with the things that you want to keep.
Yeah. Do you think it's a bit of a semantics? Do you think that's a much of an actual difference? Because I like it because it's more positive. It's less what can we cull and more what do we really love.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't the result similar, that you're just going to get rid of the things that you don't like?
I think the result is similar, but the mindset matters a lot. As we say on this podcast, this is probably the first lesson we can learn, is focusing on the positive is much more efficient and sustainable.
Yeah, it's maybe more enjoyable.
And we'll continue to talk about this, but her philosophy is also based on Shinto religion, which is that everything has a spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we treat everything like it has a spirit, or in a less spiritual way, as if it has value, when you buy things even, you'll be more conscious of it. And when you're taking care of things and maintaining them, it just proves to be more sustainable, I think, because as it is right now, say we have a frying pan that we're like, this sucks, it doesn't work anymore. But maybe next time we get a frying pan, we'll care for it a bit more in order to avoid it becoming waste. But if you were focused on just the throwing out aspect, you're like, sweet, it's done, I can throw it out and get a new one. I feel like that mindset can set in a bit. Often with clothes, I find more than anything of, you almost like want to wear it out or get it stained so you can get something new. But with her mindset, it's more, you want to maintain it so you get to keep it and love it.
I think there's that, which is just the typical kind of retail therapy, but wearing a slightly different mask. And then there's just feeling as excited to throw things or to get rid of things as you are to get things,
mm-hmm.
which is how I've always felt. But I still liked Marie's kind of more positive thinking about it. And regarding the kind of Japanese animism, so her process is to consider each item individually and fully touch it, smell it, bite it, all those kind of things. And then if you decide that it does not spark joy, which is the main question of the tidying procedure, then you kind of, she always kind of strokes it and says, thank you. That's maybe the more unnatural ritualistic element to those of us who grew up in the West, but also maybe part of the whole vibe that attracted people, because it was such a weirdly huge phenomenon. I mean, it's one thing to see something that's trending on Netflix and I think watch a couple episodes and be like, oh, it's about cleaning. But when I look back at that time, there was a real fervor, mostly with adults lining up to buy her books on this subject. And not just her, it was, as I said, it was part of a wider minimalism movement. But I do think that it was at least partially driven by this subconscious stereotype of the foreign, like, mystic wisdom coming and teaching us how to do something so basic as live. I think it's human nature, but also it is to be considered when you're discussing like the popularity of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to get into our, as I said, micro version of the Marie Kondo purge or cleaning method. I think we should preface by saying we live in a studio.
Mm-hmm.
So we call it, that's how we frame our studio apartment. We call it the studio. And it's such a small space. And we were also both kind of weaned for 2 years living in dorms on campus that I think this kind of critical thinking about the materials that surround us comes naturally. And as I say, it's always been, even when I was a kid, not to Marie Kondo's level, but that's always been a part of my personality. And I think we don't have any children, we don't have any pets. So I do think it's a lot easier depending on life state. And also, generally speaking, the older you are, the more things you accumulate.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll keep that in mind. But we've each chosen some objects for the other person to...
Con Marie
to decide whether they spark joy. And if not, they should be thrown out.
Sweet. So Marie Kondo goes through 5 stages. Stage 1 is clothing. So I have an item for you, Aaron.
I guess I'll just outline the 5, like the process. So we start with clothing, then books, then papers, then kimono, which essentially means household miscellany, art supplies, hobby stuff, kitchen stuff, whatever it may be. And then you end with sentimental items. And there's a very strict reason for this ritual. And this is something that I didn't know because I never watched the show, but I think it's a neat, I like this kind of systematized way of doing it. And she says the reason is because whereas people may be a little bit unused to making such decisions and really thinking honestly about the items, it makes sense to start with clothes, which I guess people are always kind of doing this these days. Like it seems like people are always in a permanent state of renewal. You're always saying that you are refreshing your style. I feel like you say that pretty often. Mm-hmm. And it's only every couple months that people will just throw out their whole wardrobe onto a bed and like put them into yes and no piles. So I think we're a bit more familiar with that. And also, I think just in terms of practicality, clothes are quite big.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're putting everything you own into the middle of a room or something, getting rid of clothes first makes it seem like you've done a big chunk. It's quite easy. People are already quite familiar with folding, hanging, and there's already a place for them. So mm-hmm. I think that's crucial. And secondly, with books, very similar. I think you're more likely to have curated your bookshelf at some time or regularly than you are with like the kitchen items in your home. And also there is a bookshelf. Like there's most people have a place for books. So I think there's a practicality aspect to it. And generally speaking, I agree with the order of things.
Absolutely. From a young age, going through your clothes has been a part of your life because as a child you would grow.
Yeah, you grow
so
out.
So you'd
of them.
Have to
exactly
assess and seasons, you have to put away the winter clothes, bring out the summer ones, and
yeah.
That cycle continues for your whole life. So we are starting with clothes. Aaron, the boat shirt is up for
heavens.
Auction.
I see a loose thread on it. And this was one of the garment of the weeks during our fashion semester. So longtime listeners, it's like a callback for them.
It's a cameo.
Oh, the boat shirt. Yeah, I remember him.
It was worn on the boat last episode, probably. But yeah, the boat shirt Aaron purchased in Italy, I believe.
Throw it to me. I need to touch it.
Yeah, you need to have a moment with it.
The thing is, I own so few clothes that I... Pretty much every time I open my closet, if something doesn't, like I see it all and I don't have any drawers, they're all just folded like, and they're all just hanging. I would just, and you know, I have a vicious kind of streak of throwing things out, perhaps later saying, I wish I hadn't thrown that out. Like I'm much more likely to do that rather than keep things I don't want. So I think that's what my knowledge of that habit is what keeps me. Is what keeps things like the boat shirt around. Because I know that at some point, I'll be like, oh, if only I had that boat shirt. What do you think, though?
I think for you, considering you have a total of 15 clothing items,
yeah.
None of them need to go.
Yeah.
If it got to my level and the boat shirt was still there, you could perhaps get rid of it.
The thing is, I never wear it.
Yeah, exactly. You haven't worn it in probably 2 years.
But I think this is why it's a good conversation starter, because in terms of does it spark joy, I like the way it looks. And I think it's funny. And humor is quite adjacent to joy. But I think your thoughts on particular items are a bit more simple than joy or not joy. They can be wrapped up in thoughts about yourself also. So like maybe there can be, if someone's trying to lose weight and they see a t-shirt that they do really like, but it makes them feel a certain way when they wear it or so.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Or maybe it's an aspiration that they one day want to fit into that or something. Maybe I one day want to have enough beachly... boatly swagger to be able to pull off this shirt, but for now I think yeah. I'm too much of a Poindexter. Maybe that's accurate. I don't know. Am I?
Yeah.
You think I'm a poindexter?
I don't know what that means.
Like a nerd, a dweeb.
Yeah, I think you're too land-dwelling to have a boat shirt.
She thinks I'm a grubber.
Yeah. What I have learned when curating a wardrobe is to never keep things aspirationally. I used to do this a lot, and this is what made me have a wardrobe probably twice the size a few years ago, of keeping things for a special event, having a bunch of fancy dresses, having clothes that don't fit anymore. One way or the other, something that used to fit you and you shrunk, or you got bigger, or you grew even like height wise. Sometimes I have the aspiration of shrinking so that the pants will fit, you know? So not keeping them, because the clothes are there to serve you, to dress you, make you feel good. If you put something on and it makes you feel bad, then like, why would you keep it around?
But what about the vision of, I want to sail and have a boat?
Well, that's the thing. When you see that, it doesn't make you sad.
No.
Because it's a positive aspiration that isn't necessarily tied to your self-worth.
And also there's memory tied to it. Because when I see this, maybe more than most clothes, it's the experience of us buying it. Because we were kind of, you know, it's like freewheeling vacation time. Like, oh, we're going to have, you know, gelato every day. And Aaron's going to wear a boat shirt. So crazy. You know, like that's the feeling. And if we went on vacation again,
you'd be bringing that.
Of course.
No matter where it is, Alaska.
First name on the team sheet. This would be if we went to the Yukon or something like that. So, and maybe it's also not relevant to this item of clothing, but something I noted while preparing for the episode, which sounds maybe a little bit, to use the therapy speak, codependent, but I don't think it's that bad, is that when you are married, as we are, your possessions don't just become your own. They also become part owned by your spouse.
Yeah,
so for instance, like there might be, I don't think there are any, but there might be some clothes that I don't like that much. But if you really like it, then I'd keep it because that's being nice. It's like, does it spark joy in me? Not really, but maybe it sparks joy in someone else. Or it's similar to if you have like kids things all around your apartment, maybe. It's like, it's your apartment, but that massive like bear might spark joy in the kids, so you're not going to get rid of it.
Yeah. Definitely working together as a family to declutter is important, instead of doing the tyrannical thing of just throwing everything out.
I think it actually has happened, maybe I could count on two hands or so, the amount of times that you have had a purge of your wardrobe and had clothes in a bag to be donated or discarded in some other way. And I see it and I'm like, what? You're getting rid of that t-shirt? And you're like, I haven't worn that in 5 years. And I just slowly put it back in the closet. So I'm like, you're not getting rid of that. That's not fair. But also, I don't think it's, I don't know. I think there's the codependent thing, or like the someone's being whipped. If you want to keep the thing out of fear of the other person, or not fear, but like worry that the other person will be annoyed if you threw it out. Mm-hmm. But if you want to keep it more out of, to use the positive line of thinking again, as a mini gift to the other person, then it's like that.
Yeah. And if your partner or your kids are people that you trust, as they should be, maybe they know that something's better for you than you know. So perhaps in the kitchen when you're decluttering, I'm like, oh, I never really use this whisk. But you said, maybe you should. Instead of just always vigorously stirring, you could use the whisk. And they're helping you out.
Like our whisk that falls apart.
Yeah.
Less said about that, the better. So the next item is books. I have one for you. It's a very cartoon-looking book. I'm holding it up for the people on YouTube. Hopefully you can see. Also, we wanted to say a big thank you to all the new YouTube subscribers. It's almost a whole new paradigm for us. We're almost at double, right? Like 230 or so subscribers. And obviously it's a small amount and we don't get that many views compared to some podcasts. But for us, seeing any kind of comment or email especially makes Alicia's day. She always says, Aaron, did you see that comment? And I'm like, yeah, it was probably a bot. But still,
yeah,
it's a nice thing.
Even if you're not a bot, comment.
Yeah. Let us know you're real. We're also on all the podcast app though. So if you discover us on YouTube, you can also listen on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, all that stuff. But I guess today's episode is quite visual. So this book is one called The Little Dictionary of Fashion. And it's Alicia's. I'll throw it to you.
I don't know about that.
It's hardcover, so I'll just slowly pass it.
Okay, this originally had a dust cover on it, but I liked the white cover a lot more.
Lick it.
No. I read through this twice.
I got it for you,
right? It was a gift. Yeah, you got it for me.
That's why I chose it, because I think gifts are, people think about them differently, obviously, than items that they bought themselves.
Yeah, that's true. I really like this. I could see it being on a bookshelf at a clothing store someday, which hopefully we'll be able to open with all of our pieces. I'll most likely keep it.
Does it spark joy?
It does spark joy because it reminds me of, really, when you got me this and you got me another book, it was like fashion through the 1900s.
Yes.
That year, it was the first time anyone validated me as a seamstress, I suppose.
That was my goal.
Because until that point, no one had ever bought me any sewing adjacent paraphernalia. And I feel like when you're into a hobby or into even a field of study or something and someone gets you a gift, it really affirms that. And this was also inspiring just to read through. And it's kind of annoyingly basic. Like, some of them are just jackets, jewelry.
Yeah. It's an alphabet, right?
Yeah. Key to good dressing, knitwear. And my hope with this was that it would be more
in depth, kind of.
Yeah. It would be a bit of a guide of, this is what a French seam is, or this is what an imperial collar is, and those more unknown things. But these are basically just all known words.
B for button.
Yeah, feathers.
That's emphasis. Still fun, though. But the reason I chose it is because I figured you'd say it's about joy, at least I hope so.
Yeah.
But I think this is not the Marie Kondo method, but there are some other minimalists who will try and push this imperative that if you haven't used it, let's say in 2 years or various different kind of arbitrary rules like that based on time or usage, then you should get rid. Whereas she's much more just purely emotional. Mm. And I think it's an example that you don't need to always be using everything in your home, and you don't need to, for instance, be regularly rereading every book on your bookshelf for it to have value there, kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. And with books, especially now that we are in a partnership, it's funny. I would used to get rid of a lot of books that I had read. If they were nonfiction, especially, I read it once. I know I'm not going to go back to it, and I would get rid of it. But now with you, it's like I'll finish a book and you'll say, I'll probably read that someday, and vice versa. So we keep a lot of books around because we both read them. We are both, I don't want to say big rereaders, but we're both rereaders.
I want to become more of one, for sure.
Yeah. So our bookshelf is quite curated, and probably once or twice a year we'll go through and get rid of the random books on running or the random books on, like, how to tie a knot.
I think it's mostly just limited by the shelf space.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what determines it.
For sure. This is a big place where Marie Kondo diverges from minimalism as well, because minimalism to me is a lot about the aesthetics of having a bookshelf that's all beige and white.
With like three books on it?
Exactly. But with Marie Kondo, it's like, for you and I, these books spark a lot of joy and have a lot of value. And if you looked at our bookshelves, they're the opposite of minimalistic. They look pretty maximalist. They have books every which way. They're pretty stuffed.
You can kind of see one behind me a little bit.
Yeah. And it's still being minimalist for you and I. It's having the minimal amount of books that we require to get through our day, really. But with the minimalists, they would see it and they'd be like, you're so, like, you must be so cluttered. It must take up so much mind space and it's hurting you. But it's not a value judgment if you have a lot of books.
It's one of the points that I really don't like about that minimalism is, well, two points, actually. One is that it so often is removing physical items because they take up space and saying, why have a record collection? You can just have an iPod. Why have a whole bookshelf? Get an ebook or something like that, which I think is very unsolicited, untactile, and also leads to spaces. It's kind of like the fewer things you have, the more everybody's home would look identical, because you're just reducing it to more and more the essentials.
Yeah.
But I like that character and individuality, which can be expressed in a bookshelf or a record collection or clothes or, you know, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Whatever kind of hobby. And there is also a bit of that uniformity regarding the Marie Kondo fandom. I watched an episode of her tidying someone's home, and the woman was, I wouldn't say aggrieved, but she was really fixated on learning to fold in the Marie Kondo way, fold her clothes. And I was like, not everybody needs to fold their clothes in the same shape. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But there is that kind of, I need to follow this dogma rigidly. And I like the rigidity of it. I just think you can kind of form your own.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's loosely tied to this amorphous concept of soul, which we bring up sometimes on the podcast. Something is either soul or it's not soul. And it's hard to quantify, but I will say, you know it when you see it sometimes.
I know how to describe it in this context. Soul is our book collection. It's something we've compiled over our, literally our entire lives.
Soul is everything that we do.
No, but I'm giving this one example using the books. There's books that we've had since we were kids that we have on our bookshelves.
Mm-hmm.
Not soul is you have a new apartment, you go to the bookstore or the thrift store, and you buy 50 books that are really aesthetic just to fill the shelf that you will literally never read. That feels not soul because it's not authentic or from experience. It's not lived in. It's just trying to appear lived in. And I feel like as a reaction to the minimalist movement, maximalism has become a thing. And to me, I really like the maximalist aesthetic. And my goal with this apartment and with basically not this apartment, but our lives once we got married and moved into our own space was to not do the unsoul thing of just buying a bunch of decor, buying a bunch of things to make it look lived in, but just slowly over our many years of marriage,
live in it.
Yeah, because I always had these friends whose family homes looked so lived in. There would just be a throw blanket on the couch, which was there for 50 years. There'd be an apron on a hook that had like a little tear in it and was mended.
Yeah.
But if a lot of people...
There's like a wasp nest in the corner of the living room.
Exactly. People who like the cottagecore aesthetic just try and make it look like that without actually living it. And I think we can... Those aesthetics only really work in a soulful and emotional way if it's authentic and comes from a few years. You have to be a bit more long-term minded than just, this is the aesthetic I want, I'm going to go buy everything in it.
Sure. Which of our two bookshelves is the most soul? We have this kind of typical looking brown wooden one behind me, which is rather squat and used to have glass doors on it, which we took them off, or I took them off because I don't like things getting in the way. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell you, but the other day I was in a public building and I just walked into a glass door like a dog. I literally walked in and there were probably 25 people in the room and they all just like turned to me and one of them said, are you okay? And I was like, I'm fine. Because the glass door was just shaking really because I just walked into it at full speed.
You're a bit of a crow.
Yeah, I'm like a crow. I don't really see dimensions. So there's the brown one and there's this weirdly heavy blue plastic one.
It must be wood. It can't be plastic. Okay. It looks plastic. It's this vintage IKEA bookshelf that's bright blue.
I think that one's in the soul. Mostly because it's tied to my sweat and, of course, a little bit of blood when I had to carry it to our apartment.
I'm going to say the brown one's more soul, mainly because I like the books on that one better than the blue bookshelf. That's just by coincidence.
Okay. So after books, we go to papers, which are kind of just like tiny books in a sense. Loose books. Unbound books.
Okay, this is your thing to decide on.
Oh, wow.
This is basically a doodle that I once did, and it was just living in my notebook. But then it somehow got put up on the wall one time when I went away.
By me.
By Aaron. So that's why I'm curious. Why is this, along with a bunch of other doodles, featured on the walls? And do they spark joy?
Let me touch it. So I know this drawing very well. This is a piece by Alicia from 2023. I know it very well because this faces me when I go to sleep, or when I try to go to sleep. So I'm always staring at it. During the night, during the morning, during those early imaginative hours. And I like several things about the colors that you've used. I've often said I think it looks like an album cover.
Mm.
So basically it's this blue, what did you use?
Pastel? It's all pastel, yeah.
Scribbles with a lemon. Let me try and get them all. Lemon, grape, strawberry, pear, orange, and apple.
Yeah.
Simple. The top six. And what I really, this sounds like a joke, but my favorite thing about it is the lettering for fruit that she's chosen at the bottom corner, as if it was a signature from the artist. But also, I adore the fact that it looks a lot more like fruft, because the I looks a lot more like an F. So yeah. I find that a funny word. I think the drawings are cute. They feel summery. And of course it sparks joy. I think it's a colorful thing to have on a wall.
Yeah.
I think it's nice. And I am, I wouldn't say kind of dogmatically opposed, but generally opposed to picture frames. I don't really like picture frames.
Mm.
I think I'm much more likely to accidentally walk into a picture frame.
It's true. We only have one picture frame.
I like flat things on the walls because I don't want them kind of intruding into the actual space. They already kind of intrude into the visual space quite a bit. Regarding my own maybe slightly bizarre sensitivity to such things, I'm also reminded of the quote from the movie Step Brothers, remember the comedy where they make their beds bunk beds?
Yeah.
And do you remember the reason?
Room for activities.
There's more room for activities. Yeah. And the joke is that they kind of don't, they have a vague sense of the activities, but they don't really know.
Yeah.
But for me, that's exactly how I feel about things. Well, I love room to walk around. And it really muddles me when there are too many things going around, whether it's my own fault from messing it or your fault or whoever's. Like when I used to live with pets, that I was slightly more annoyed than I probably should have been by just their walking and stuff like that. And I think everybody feels this to an extent. I think I maybe feel a little bit more sensitive to it than most, or I'm more conscious of it. I remember there was one morning in this apartment when I was trying to work on something. I was trying to write something, and the fridge was making a really tiny noise behind it, like the inner workings of the fridge. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And I had to pull it out and try and figure out what it was, because it was like a fly might bother you. Things like that. It's not so much about, let's say, picture frames being on an angle. Like I don't have that kind of fixation. I need everything to be flat, but I do like visual cleanliness, let's say, and auditory as well. But this picture doesn't feed into that, maybe because it's slightly more abstract. I just like colors, period. And this is just like a tiny square of color. So that's why I say this one sparks joy. But also, I think you chose it mostly because you wanted to hear me praise you on the podcast, and you just wanted to have your little pastel ego stroked. So you're welcome. Let's put it like that.
It was more the opposite, because I don't really like it.
Why don't you like Fruft?
Well, it was literally just a doodle.
Yeah.
Done in like 2 minutes. And I don't like how you have my artwork displayed everywhere when they're all basically just sketches of the soul scene or a Fruft. And my friends go over and they're like, oh, wow, you think that's good? That's probably what they're thinking in their heads.
So the thing is, similar to Marie Kondo, when she asks you to assess each item, she doesn't ask, does this spark your friend's joy?
It's true.
So that's how I decide on things. Speaking of Marie Kondo, have you been to her website?
I have.
Have you bought anything from there?
I haven't. So here's the thing. Once I was in the Marie Kondo fervor of decluttering everything, I was curious. I went to her website, and she used to sell, I remember, I want to say matcha bowls.
Oh yeah, there's still all that kind of stuff on there.
Yeah, really simple, kind of stereotypical Japanese things that she would only sell these. And then I imagine now it's probably branched into more minimalist style furniture.
It's still all on there. Like the cross section I noted for this episode, there are her wooden stacking boxes, her trademark organizers. Yeah. So if you want an organized house, buy these boxes from her, which I think is endemic of this kind of consumerist lack of imagination. You see it also in zero waste spaces or sustainability. It's like, oh, I need the zero waste kitchen organizer or the sustainable straw. It's like, you could just be a bit creative. Like, we don't have, again, I don't want to toot our own horns, because I don't think we're perfect for this. But an example is, we don't have her trademark wooden stacking boxes. We just have some crates.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, okay, put the socks in there. Like that kind of thing. So there's those. There is the traditional Japanese incense, which is for sure this Paltrow-esque Eastern mysticism, as I said.
Burn this incense and you will become
Japanese. And thirdly, my favorite one was the Spark Joy t-shirt.
That's so funny.
Just a plain t-shirt that says Spark Joy on the collar. I mean, and this is one of the reasons I think she's more of an honorary mention regarding our Rushmore rather than being a central figure. This kind of profiting off of an ethos, which is at least ostensibly anti-materialistic. I mean, the irony that it's almost boring to kind of point it out, so we'll just skip over that.
Yeah. But just word of advice to anyone listening, if an aesthetic or a movement like this catches your attention, feel free, obviously, to take lessons from it. But if it leans into taking purchases out of it, then you have to reassess. And so I was even saying with the maximalist aesthetics of, you see these, you think they're really cool, but then you then go and buy a bunch of stuff. What Marie Kondo was teaching, and my favorite lesson from it, is more about working with what you have. And that's a very Solocene concept.
Exactly.
Instead of constantly trying to, I don't like this coffee machine, I'm going to get another one. I don't like this, I'm going to get another one. Just like try and make it work. And especially when you are a young person kind of building your life from the ground up, it's really easy to get a bunch of things. And I remember talking to my friend recently. She and I both post a lot on Buns, like the trading website. And she realized she's only been living in Montreal for like 5 years, but that she's acquired a bunch of random things like a soda stream. She has 10 chairs, and it's reached a point where, why do I need all of these things? I just said yes when people would say, oh, do you want this? I'm moving. Yeah. Or when her parents would offer for her, or she'd see it in a thrift store. And now working to declutter and really reassess the things and if they spark joy, if they have a purpose, if they're...
I think it's hard to escape that accumulation mindset. And also part of the nuance with the spark joy is that it may not spark joy now, but perhaps it could. Like, yeah. Perhaps you have a pair of pants that don't spark joy, but they could if you hemmed them or dyed them or sewed on a patch or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a couple more things. One is I was thinking a lot about when preparing for this episode, it goes in with the consumerism, but also the class concept of minimalism. I won't get too into it because there are people who have written much more articulate articles than I will be right now. But when I think of minimalism, I think of Kim and Kanye West's house.
It's expensive, in other words.
Yeah, it's expensive because you and I, we can't afford to just throw something out if we can't, we're not using it at the moment, because we'll probably use it in 2 months.
Yeah.
And I feel like the minimalist mindset is often like, if you're not, if you haven't used it in 2 weeks, get rid of it. But you have to think ahead a bit because you can't afford to constantly be rebuying things.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Sarah Therese, the once minimalist YouTuber, now she's pivoted into something else, but she often talks about how she'll donate things to the thrift store, and then literally if she realizes a week later that she doesn't want them, she'll go there and buy them back if they're still on the shelf. And it's kind of like, I guess that's anti-Marie Kondo of not thinking ahead. I'm just thinking in the moment, oh, I want to get rid of so many things, but then
yeah,
having to buy them back. And also especially that like clean aesthetic of which Marie Kondo, I feel like, really pushes for. You can tell in just the way she dresses.
Mm-hmm.
She's pushing this message and this idea of everything being pristine. But even herself, once she had a couple kids, she pivoted away from that.
Of course.
Kind of had the realization having pure white sheets and pure white clothes doesn't really work if you're actually living.
Period.
Yeah.
So the next category after papers is kimono, miscellany. And it's for you. Or should I say it's for yo? Yo-yo.
This yo-yo.
Holding it up. I'll let Alicia tell the story because I actually don't know where this came from. I do know why. It's because Alicia goes through many phases. Like this category had a lot of honorable mentions. I was going to pull out the violin, but I was like, the yo-yo is small. It's easier for me to throw this across to you. And it's a slightly more fun and solo-scene kitschy object. And violin's too heavy. Everyone likes a yo-yo. Everyone can play a yo-yo.
Yeah.
Not everyone can play a violin. And Alicia, of course, went through the phase of trying to become a pro-yo.
A pro-yo-yoer. Basically, I was a nanny for a while, and I went to the toy store to get a gift for a birthday. And then I saw this yo-yo at the cash register and harkened back to Nova Scotia in the year 2007 when there was this guy touring who was a professional yo-yoer, and he basically did this show teaching us all how to yo-yo. Not just up and down, like there were...
Walking the dog, everything.
Everything.
Of course.
And...
The Galactic Roundabout. I made that one up. But
he basically was peddling these DVDs and these special yo-yos.
Did you buy a DVD?
I had a DVD.
Okay.
I don't know if it was mine or if one of my friends got it, but we were all on the yo-yo
train
and we were watching these DVDs teaching you how to do these tricks. And I just had a flashback and I just bought it. It was too expensive, honestly. I mean, a yo-yo should be like $2, but this was like a posh, fancy yo-yo.
It's wooden. It's nice though.
It's very nice. And I thought, I'll buy it, and even if I don't become a professional yo-yo, it's a nice thing.
I think at this point, I may have yo-yoed more than you have.
Yeah, exactly. But it's fun as adults to have a couple...
Toys
kicking around. So this is fun. We keep it just by the TV, so if you don't feel like watching TV, but you want to entertain yourself, you can use the yo-yo.
Have guests around.
Yeah.
Anyone want a snack? Do a few yo-yos?
Yeah.
Walk the dog?
That's the thing. And I think it's fun, and... I really like it. It's beautiful. If it was just a plastic one, I probably would have got rid of it by now.
So it sparks joy.
It sparks joy.
It has that old-fashioned, handmade Geppetto wooden toy aesthetic to it that we like.
Exactly. And with the violin, in a weird way, it's like the opposite of this. I got the cheapest violin. It doesn't work. It's annoying. Every time I try and tune it, the strings break. So it doesn't spark joy. Mm. I wanted it to, and I really wanted to learn violin, but it's like if it can't be in tune, then... why keep it around sort of thing. And now I know it's this in between of not buying too much. When you do buy, buying value, or I mean quality.
If you're going to splurge on a yo-yo, get the good yo-yo. Does it even have a brand on it or anything like that?
No.
It's just hand-carved design.
Yeah, but I really like it.
It's very smooth. Mm. And I thought it would also be, we could mention that something you and I bonded over when we first met was that we always felt growing up, it's a strange thing to share, but we always felt that we had too many toys growing up, mm-hmm. which also sounds really whiny and kind of first world. But it's not that I wasn't grateful for those kind of things. It was always just an objective. I don't even know if I have enough hours in the day to play with all this kind of thing. Maybe it's a middle class Christmas thing,
yeah,
where you just, you receive so many toys growing up that one, you grow out of them very quickly. And two, mm-hmm. as I said, you can only form kind of attachments or engagements with so many objects. And there was a stat I saw, depending on where you read it, a lot of children only play with 5 to 20% of their toys. Mm-hmm. And so I thought this kind of spoke to the way that we relate to each other materially. And it sounds like I'm disparaging parents or whatever, but that's not the case, because I think a lot of them maybe in a sense spoil their kids like this because mm-hmm. it's like a out of love, and also because maybe it's in a sense slightly apologetic because they can't share that much of their time with them. Maybe it's mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah, I was reading quite a few think pieces on minimalism and Marie Kondo, and they were saying it's only a value. Minimalism is only a virtue if you choose it. And so a lot of middle class and lower class families, they're minimalist by force. They don't have a choice but to only have a few things. And then I feel like, especially with buying your kids toys, buying other kids toys for birthdays, that is sort of an assertion of
control almost. Yeah.
Control of, no, I have enough money to like get you a bunch of toys. Mm-hmm. And that's how it felt growing up. And I see it a lot just in every family of, yeah, we don't have enough time to spend together, but you kind of buy toys as an apology.
Yeah.
And kids' toys are also just so cheap and easy to come by. You get them by hand-me-downs. Like, you acquire them in a lot of different ways. Because, under the Christmas tree, but also your neighbor's kids grew out of them, so they pawn them off to you, and then it becomes a bit of a burden. And I've seen families that I work with saying, like, don't get us toys for the birthday or Christmas, but not everyone would feel comfortable saying that for one reason or another. And so it's very mixed up in culture and social pressures. But with kids' toys, I really like the Montessori method of really cultivating you really are supposed to only have, I think, 6 to 8 toys out at a time for the kids, and then it sparks their imagination a bit more.
Okay. And the final category of item to assess, having gone from clothes to books to papers to kimono, and along that way, getting more comfortable with effectively saying yes or no, or I guess getting into your own emotion of the thing and saying whether it sparks joy or not, the most contentious category of all. I'm holding up. His name is Lawrence, and this is Alicia's stuffed sheep. Stuffed animal.
So Lawrence is going nowhere.
He's going really nowhere
fast. So Lawrence was purchased from Superstore in 2014. So I was too old to want to buy a stuffed animal, but I saw him on the shelf and I just thought, this is the cutest thing I've ever seen. And I had no money. I was 14. And then I saved my money. And actually, it's almost his anniversary. I got him on Easter.
So I said it's a decade.
Yeah. And I got Lawrence. And he's been with me ever since. He's just the cutest little sheep. He's plump and round, has a kind of confused look on his face. And I feel like a lot of people have Lawrences. I've seen them all over because they're just, like, they sell them at the dollar store and stuff now. They're just, it's a...
The Laura, yeah. They're proliferating.
Silhouette, which people are probably familiar with. They come in all sizes.
Yeah, that's my favorite creepy thing. One time when I was going in your... in your house, and I just opened a random door and there were like 7 different ones ranging up to, it was like Pokemon Evolutions. Like the final one was just half the size of the room.
Yeah. I think because I got Lawrence, but then my sisters got in the Lawrence fandom.
Lawrence
and so
squared,
they,
Lawrence cubed.
They started getting a bunch of other ones.
He doesn't like me.
No, because Aaron uses him as a pillow.
I do. And also sometimes very often I throw him around and sometimes he lands on his eye. And then Alicia always says, one of these days, his eyes are going to come off, and I'm going to blame you.
Well, you used to intentionally throw it at the ceiling to hear that that little click that the eye makes.
I do like the sound. You can.
I'll put it in the mic.
Who knows what this episode is devolving into? I think he's the most relevant for the Japanese term for spark joy, which is tokimeku. Excuse the pronunciation, but I saw that they were, when they were translating, because Marie Kondo, she was big in Japan before she before she hit the States. When they were translating that specific phrase, it's not really an exact thing. So they were debating like to spark joy, but also to palpitate or to have your heart flutter or something like that. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's closer to the sentimental items.
Yeah, he gives me butterflies in my stomach because he's so cute.
To throb.
But yeah, the sentimental items, it took me a while to understand decluttering those because I feel like, I don't know if you did, but in the town where I grew up, all the kids had these things called hope chests. And our parents had them and our grandparents had them. And basically they're these chests that you get when you're a kid and you put sentimental items
into
them.
Yeah, it wasn't called that though. Well, mine didn't have such a name, but it was this, it was shaped like a house. Mm. Mine was, the lid was like a roof.
Okay.
Yeah,
but we had hope chests and you'd put things into them. Then I remember reaching a point where I was like, it's full. So you have to almost reassess the things.
I have no more hope left.
Yeah. But then I remember I'd have t-shirts from running events or from our trip to Campeche and things. And I was like, these hold memories, but a photo in the chest would probably be more valuable than just the t-shirt that you wore.
Yeah, I don't need a lock of my hair from when I was 9.
Right. Yeah. You only need one lock of hair. You don't need a bunch. You don't need all your teeth, just one. Yeah, it's definitely a hard category to declutter, but I think if it's just annoying to store, then reassess. If you have a bunch of space and you just want to store everything, then go for it. I think that's cool as well. I know some people who have basically farmhouses or cottages where they store a lot of their stuff, and then it's also cool to pass it down to your grandkids and say, hey, this is the Lawrence I had when I was a kid, and you can have him now too.
He doesn't have any eyes left, but...
Yeah. Your grandfather really hated those eyes. The villain of the week, speaking of hate...
Whoa!
I think that might be copyrighted, but... is Oscar the Grouch. So, this is Oscar of the Grouch species. I didn't realize that Grouch was a species, but it is from Sesame Street. His favorite thing is trash. He's misanthropic. And he reminds me of Marie before her... enlightenment of really liking trash, throwing things in the trash.
Reminds me of myself.
Living in a trash can, yeah. And some fun facts about Oscar the Grouch is that in the first season of Sesame Street, he was orange.
Now he's blue?
He's green.
Oh, whoops.
Yeah, and that was explained by he took a trip to the swamp.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but he was orange, which is weird because he's very green. And now he's actually Oscar the recycling grouch or something like that, which I don't like. Leave him in the trash can. And apparently he was contentious at a certain point because he was originally installed into the Sesame Street gang to represent someone who's different than everyone else. Everyone else is joyful and very, it's a type of person on Sesame Street. But then they were like, we want to have a variety of types of people. So we want to have this kind of grumpy person.
He's like the Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh.
Exactly. But then people were like, oh, you're saying that people who are of low income live in trash cans and are grumpy. And they were like, nope, we're just trying to say that you have to be nice to grumpy people, too. It was a whole thing, but still, he's the villain of the week.
Okay.
And one other fun fact about him is that, I just say look into it yourselves, but there are a lot of localizations of Sesame Street, and they're not just localizations, they're basically the Sesame Street organization makes the puppets, and then there's people who act them out and voice them in the different countries. And in Germany, Oscar the Grouch has a pet called Gustav. He's Caterpillar Gustav, which in America, his pet is Slimy the Worm. So I thought it was funny. Caterpillar Gustav, and Gustav was one of our other features on the Mount Rushmore semester. But just look into the localizations because they're so funny. Like, just the names of them and stuff are hilarious. And they all, like, live in different places. So, like, some places he lives in oil bins. Some places he lives in just in a tailor shop. He's a grumpy tailor in one of them. And it's just interesting to see what different cultures see as where the grumpy people are. So for us, the grumpy people are in a trash can. But for others, they're just in the tailor shop. So yeah, don't be Oscar the Grouch. don't live in a trash can. Unless you like trash cans.
Unless, and some of us do. Thank you all for listening. Hopefully this episode sparked joy. It's a little bit corny to say. Have a nice day. See you next week.